Five Things First Thing with JR Morning's Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds.
6:05, good to have you this morning. Tuesday, it's Giving Tuesday. That's nice.
Yes, very
Giving
nice.
Tuesday's nice. And I think that, during the holiday season, that mentality is even more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And it sure feels like the holidays with the snow out there, driving pretty carefully down 94.
Yeah, it was a little slick this morning.
Actually doing 55 on the lodge.
People were actually doing the speed limit.
They were. It was wild.
it's not something you normally see on the racetrack.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So just be careful out there if you're getting ready this morning, if you're getting ready to shove off, just buy yourself a little extra time because it is a little slick, even in places where you might not see that thin layer of snow.
Right.
So the White House confirmed yesterday a report that was initially published by the Washington Post that said that there was not one but two strikes on one of these drug boats.
Mm-hmm. The first strike.
The very first operation that they conducted. And the order was eliminate the threat, which is not only the narcotics that were on board, but then the runners that were manning this craft.
Okay.
And the first strike took out the boat, but there were two survivors still. Well, then another order came to eliminate the threat to the United States, which were those drug traffickers. And the second strike went through. So at one point, there was a question to Caroline Leavitt yesterday that was there an initial order from Secretary Pete Hegseth? And did he give the second order or did he empower the next in command to give that order?
Here she is from the podium. Then we'll talk about it. Well, we can't find it right now.
Yeah.
We'll find it later.
But she said that it was the order from the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, Secretary of War, to eliminate the threat, the next in command gave that second go-ahead.
It was an admiral.
Correct.
Right. Admiral Frank M. Bailey, Mitch Bailey, to conduct these kinetic strikes. And they're saying that he is the one that ordered it, and it's well within the Pentagon's rules that he should have done that. So it's just a little different than when it first started. Hegseth came out and said the Washington Post article is fabricated. It's not true. And, denied the second strike at all. Now the second strike is, yes, that did happen, mm-hmm. but everything is on the up and up.
Well, she's also saying that this is within the rules of, this isn't an illegal order, that this is within the rules of the United States in compliance with all U.S. laws and international laws that would pertain to war. So that in terms of what the United States is doing in terms of these strikes, they are lawful under both U.S. and international law, according to the White House.
So Hegseth said eliminate the threat. And so they shoot the boat, blow up the boat, still have survivors. And so the admiral, I guess, and I'm just speculating here, mm-hmm. says, well, the boss said eliminate the threat. So I'm just doing what he told me to do. I'm eliminating the threat.
Correct.
But what this hubbub is all about is, from Geneva, these, directions when it comes to war and how you're supposed to treat people. These people were now sort of incapacitated on a floating vessel. And mm-hmm. did the second strike need to happen or was it a war crime?
We're going to talk to Javed Ali, the associate professor of practice on counterterrorism and domestic terrorism at the University of Michigan, coming up at 6:19, give you some more clarity.
The historic Packard plant, it was once a hub for luxury automobile manufacturing, has sat, largely empty for decades. A lot of people have come and said they were going to do something with it. Parts of the site demolished and remaining structures considered an eyesore, but that could soon change. City leaders unveiled yesterday plans to redevelop a 28-acre portion of the site into what's going to be called Packard Park. It's going to be a mixed-use project that will include adaptive reuse of existing buildings south of Grand Boulevard and the construction of a new 400,000-square-foot manufacturing facility. The development is set to transform the area with multiple building uses and expanded outdoor public spaces, signaling a major step forward in revitalization of one of Detroit's most iconic historic sites. Now, Mayor Duggan, who was at the press conference, will be with us this morning at 7:49 to talk more about it.
That's good news. It's very good news.
Always good news to get those eyesores out of the way. The train station was one, and Packard plant has been another mm-hmm. eyesore. get that out of the way.
Yeah, very cool.
100%. Back to national news, this idea of changing all asylum decisions after and in the wake of the shooting of those two National Guard members in Washington, D.C. Since that happened last week, the administration is doing many, many things, like pausing all asylum decisions for migrants currently in the United States, reviewing the green cards that allow people from 19 countries, most from Middle East or Africa, to live and work here, and reassessing the asylum approvals issued during the Biden administration. So how many people is that to do all of those steps? About 1.5 million migrants with pending asylum cases in this country. It's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot of work
that
needs to be done. Meanwhile, Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, saying that she met with the president yesterday. She wrote on X, and I am recommending a full travel ban on every damn country that's been flooding our nation with killers, leeches, and entitlement junkies. Our forefathers built this nation on blood, sweat, and the unyielding love for freedom, not for foreign invaders to slaughter our heroes, suck dry our hard-earned tax dollars, or snatch the benefits owed to Americans. We don't want them, not one.
That goes too far for me, that tweet. I mean, this person did an evil act and killed two people. Mm-hmm. Let's focus on that. It doesn't mean everyone who comes here from a different country is that.
See, I guess my desire would be you be proactive in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, be proactive in making sure that anybody who is here who has sought asylum has done so through the proper channels, has been properly vetted. Like, it's always the reaction that gets.
Oh,
me.
Yeah.
Like, I get it, right? There is a demand when an action happens that there is a reaction.
Sure.
Understood. But at the same time, why don't we make sure that we are doing our due diligence on the front end so that one of our National Guard's soldiers isn't dead?
Because due diligence is subjective. People believe that they did their due diligence with this person, vetted them in a Middle Eastern country. He was here working. It seems like there was some mental health breakdown there, which, again, we go back to mental health. What are our services here? What have you? And then that person killed a young 20-year-old whose life snuffed out. It doesn't mean that every immigrant
does this. No.
Because, you know, they may have vetted him. He came over here and was radicalized here in the United States. So, I mean, this is after...
Allegedly. Something they're working on, yeah.
You know, after the vetting. So things, you know, could have changed between then and now.
Meanwhile, you've got Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner meeting with Vladimir Putin today.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
In Moscow?
Yeah.
Yep.
What are they bringing to him?
I don't know, because so once this, at least a portion of this 28-point plan that was leaked last week, once that kind of became available, it was obvious that this was going to be really kind of leaning heavy towards Russia, right, in terms of what was going to be good for the both sides in this thing.
Yeah.
And it sent Europe into a tailspin, and obviously there was concerns on the Ukrainian side, but Ukraine agreed to this. So there is, you know, now some hope that Vladimir Putin's going to agree. I don't trust anything about Vladimir Putin.
Well, see, that's the thing. People say, suppose you get a deal and Vladimir says, okay, it's the security after the fact that Zelensky needs, because he doesn't trust him, and, you know, doesn't mean that Putin is going to, you know, stay the course.
Right. So over a decade ago, Russia goes and takes Crimea.
Yeah.
You know, 11 years, well, not quite now, 11 years later, but within the decade, they went and started another issue with Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't believe anything Vladimir Putin says.
Devil's advocate, what are they supposed to do? Not try?
Absolutely.
I appreciate the try.
Sure.
And Witkoff and Jared Kushner got it done in Gaza. I mean, we'll see.
Five things first thing with JR Morning on 760 WJR.
So on the heels of that Washington Post report that seemingly confirmed that there were two strikes on the very first attack on the alleged drug boats in the Caribbean, the drug runner boats, that now the spotlight is on, once again, these military maneuvers that the United States is championing. Let's bring in Javed Ali, the Associate Professor of Practice on Counterterrorism and Domestic Terrorism at the University of Michigan. Professor, it's good to have you this morning.
Chris, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your perspective, the developments on this story over the last 24 hours or so. This Washington Post story comes out, and then the United States says that, yes, there was two strikes on this particular boat. Is there a violation there, or is this the United States acting in a way in accordance with the law as they see it?
So this is a really complicated issue to sort through, and obviously for all of us on the outside looking in, we don't know all the details of truly what happened. But let's try and look at this from perhaps the legal perspective first. There's been a debate over the past few months about whether these strikes against alleged drug boats in the Caribbean are legal. There's some people who say they aren't. The administration is sticking to its position that they are. And I believe that legal justification is under President Trump's broad authorities as commander-in-chief under Article 2 of the Constitution, and then this interpretation that because these cartels are trying to bring drugs into the United States, that gives the legal authority now to use military force. Now, if that's the legal justification the administration is using, then sort of the operational part is perhaps what the Washington Post story is uncovering, is why two strikes against one boat that killed several people on it, and then the second strike that may have then killed survivors. Was that legal or not? And again, I think we're going to just have to wait and see how that plays out. But I have to believe, and having come from that world of U.S. counterterrorism, that from the military, they thought what they were doing was legal. Whether it now passes another level of scrutiny, we're just going to have to figure out how that goes.
Professor, the president says he didn't know whether the second strike even happened and that he wouldn't have wanted it. Now, how unusual is that for a president to be unclear about a kinetic strike, especially one that has maybe some potential legal fallout?
Sort of interesting aspect to this. Now, the president gave or has given the military the authority to conduct these operations in the Caribbean, and there have been 20, at least 20, since early September. I don't know the answer to this, but I have a hard time believing that every time one of these strikes has happened, that President Trump has been actually cognizant of these strikes in real time. Whereas we've seen these other moments with presidents, President Obama, President Trump as first term, sort of being in the White House Situation Room, watching a counterterrorism operation unfold, the raid against Osama bin Laden, the raid against the ISIS leader with President Trump in 2019, I don't think President Trump has been that involved. So, in the strike that's causing all the controversy, was President Strike monitoring it in real time, and was there did he have some ability to say, hey, what are we doing between the first strike and the second strike? I would have to believe almost very likely that didn't happen. So this is just the reality of what counterterrorism looks like. Once the president gives the authority for the military or another department or agency to engage in these operations, the president isn't going to be tracking what happens unless it's something of the magnitude of a Osama bin Laden raid or a raid against a major terrorist leader.
We're talking about possibly the second strike. Could it be a war crime or not? But congressmen have asked the legality of it anyway, at its face, of civilians who are smuggling drugs, if they deserve this lethal strike from our country.
Right. These legal issues. So this was not, the U.S. military was involved in the operation, but the target on the boat itself was not another armed force. It was a boat allegedly with cartel members and drugs on there, you know, or some combination of those, too. So again, the first strike may have been legal based on the justification the administration has been using, and the Department of Justice has also reportedly written a memo saying that these operations are legal under that justification. But the second strike, if it were these civilians, and again, not members of any Latin American military, on the boat, then was that a legitimate, valid strike, or was it actually something else for which now members of the military could be prosecuted, or civilian authorities in the Pentagon who approved it or oversaw it? I mean, that's the issue at play, and I'm not a lawyer, so it's hard for me to kind of know the answer to that. And this is why I think Congress is now going to try to look into this, because if these operations continue, this will probably happen again. And probably Congress wants to understand, you know, what are the rules of engagement? How is the military operating? What is the basis for which they determine when to strike and not to strike? And how do you know whether, you know, people who survive should be rescued, or whether you make the determination to hit a boat again?
Professor Javed Ali at the University of Michigan, appreciate your time. Don't be a stranger. I have a feeling we'll be talking again very soon.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, you got it. And then I guess the other question is this an effective method of deterrence? Like, is this going to stop these cartels from bringing these narcotics into the United States? Now, the president's saying, you know, the drugs that they're bringing in could save 250,000, 25,000 lives, whatever it is. I mean, that can be effective.
Absolutely.
But there are many ways in which they're bringing these drugs into the United States.
And how many boats have they hit so far?
A handful?
Yeah.
There have been 21 strikes, 83 people dead.
Okay, so whoever, you know, they're continuing to try to bring, if that's what it is, drugs on the boat, they're continuing to try to bring it, and they know that they're, you know, getting shot out of the water, but they continue to try to do it. So is it a deterrent?
I don't know.
I don't know. But then, like, you want to stop the drugs. It's killing
sure.
Americans. We got to do that. But then we pardon the ex-president of Honduras who's in a U.S. prison for drug trafficking.
Yeah, for 45
years.
That
doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. And this has been kind of my issue with this administration thus far, is you kind of do one thing and then you do something else that goes against another avenue that you're traveling. It feels counterintuitive.
Right. If you're anti-drug trafficking, then maybe don't pardon this.
Just
president.
Be all across the board. Anti-drug trafficking.
Well, the president said he did it because he was told by the Venezuelan people that, the Honduran people, rather, that it was a Biden setup. That's what he said.
Well, he also said that he wouldn't have wanted that second strike, the president said yesterday, which is interesting. Because you order the first strike, that's fine. But he also said that the first strike was lethal. It was fine, that he wouldn't have wanted the second one. So just an interesting side note.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. More next to JR Morning.
The U.S. Department of Transportation recently introduced a new female crash dummy. So they're trying to up safety for women, which I obviously love. What they were using was a dummy model that was just basically based on male proportions, but just a little lighter. So that doesn't do the job. So this sounds like the right move here. Jessica Jermakian is the vice president of vehicle research at Insurance Institute for Highway Safety to get into this further. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
How did this come about that they were going to change the proportions here to better serve all the women in our country who drive in cars?
Well, so there has been a crash test dummy that has had female proportions for more than 30 years now. But this new dummy, what this new dummy does is it uses more female-specific data to refine some of the parts.
Okay.
Some of the aspects to make them more female-like and interact with the vehicle in a more female-like way. So this is great news.
Well, the new dummy concentrates, I understand, on the types of injuries that women suffer most often. What do we now understand about how women are injured differently in crashes? And why did it take this long for the industry to address it?
Well, so we know women are at increased risk compared with men when they're in a crash. Some of those differences are due to differences in the types of crashes they're in. Women are more likely to be in the struck vehicle in a side impact crash or a rear impact crash, and that can put them at increased risk. But we also know when we compare crashes kind of apples to apples, very similar crashes between men and women, where we see the biggest differences are in the legs, specifically like the ankles and feet.
By the way, this is Mobility Makers, brought to you by Bridgestone. Getting people down the road matters, but getting generations down them, that's what really matters. Bridgestone, whatreallymatters.com to learn more. And this is our Mobility Makers segment. I think it works perfectly here. So as you said, there are different sensors now on this Thor 05F, which sounds like something on James Bond or something.
Marvel.
Yeah. And so it changes differences, including the neck, collarbone, pelvis, and legs, just to reflect more of what women look like.
Yes. And so this new dummy has updated information and updated sensors, additional sensors that we can now use to potentially drive vehicle improvements,
but what,
you know, through crash test programs.
What will those answers give, you know, car makers? Can they change the car just for women?
Well, an important part is to make sure that what we're measuring in the dummy, we can tie that back to risk for real world risk for women. And so that's the next step that we need to do as people who use crash test dummies, is understand how we can use all those new sensors to help predict those risks of injury. Once we're able to do that, then the automakers can design changes into the vehicle to help mitigate those risks.
I don't know, automakers will eventually be required to test with this Thor 05F once it's approved. How big a shift do you think that's going to be for the industry when it comes to cost, training, and redesign?
Well, it is true that this new dummy is more expensive than the dummies that we're currently using. And something that is important to remember is that the dummies we're currently using have done a really good job of driving vehicle improvements that are benefiting everyone, women included.
I think this is a great step in the right direction. Jessica Jermakian, thanks for joining us for Mobility Makers this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I got to tell you, speaking of autos,
yeah.
So yesterday during the show, my wife calls me and she's like, my car won't start.
We were here for that initial call. Yes.
It was very frantic. So I was like, all right, well, I'll get home as quick as I can, see if I can figure it out.
Uh-huh.
Spoiler alert, I can't figure anything out on a car. I don't know anything about any of it. I'm lucky that I can change a windshield wiper, all right?
You just click those on.
Yeah, well, I got to make sure I, you know, go on YouTube and find the right video for the corresponding windshield wiper to make sure I put it on correctly. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So I get home, and I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it's the engine. I have no idea. So it's not starting. So I'm like, well, we have one of those battery jumper cable things.
Mm-hmm.
So I
technical term.
You know. So I make sure it's charged. I go out there, hook it up to the battery, and then I go to start the car. It the lights come on, all the electronics come on, but it doesn't start. And then 2 seconds later, all the lights go out. I'm like, boy, maybe it's the alternator. I don't know. So I call the dealership and I make an appointment for this morning at 7:30. Then I call AAA.
Okay.
So AAA comes out, and the guy's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I don't know. It's not starting, and then now the battery doesn't work, and I don't know what's... He's like, do you need a tow or do you need a jump? And I'm like, well, I tried the jump. I did that. He's like, well, let's try my thing. And I'm like, all right. Hooked it up, started right away. I mean, right away started. And I'm like... Oh, so maybe it was just the battery. Maybe you were right. It's like, no big deal. Like, I'm glad you're here. Thank you. Like, it was so wild. I'm like, I don't know anything about cars, anything. And so that was nice. So it saved me a trip to the dealership and saved me a tow and that whole deal. But
there's still a problem, right?
There is some sort of problem. Yeah.
Something's draining the battery.
Yeah. But it was nice that we got it taken care of at that moment.
Uh-huh.
We'll, you know, now we'll make it fit into our schedules nicer to get into the dealership. But
did he laugh at you?
Yeah, he laughed. I mean, he didn't really laugh at me.
He just put you on blast right here.
But like, he definitely.
He's putting himself on blast.
Oh, I got no shame in my game. He definitely like told somebody about me.
He's like, this guy.
Yeah.
Went back to work and said, dude.
This guy, I think he's on the radio.
Yeah. Yeah, he went back and told his family, he's like, I don't know, this guy thought he knew what he was talking about, and turns out he did not know anything about what he was talking about.
Can I say something, and this is no shade to you? I feel like back in the day, everyone kind of just knew how to do more things like that, like tinker on a car or whatever. Well, like, my dad knows how to do all the things.
Same. Yeah. My dad knows how to do everything as well.
And my brothers, and I can do a few things, but let me tell you who can do it is my wife.
Really?
That's great.
Marie knows a lot about cars, so by the time we get in, we can usually figure it out, but it's usually her.
Like, during the pandemic.
She's like Marissa Tomei.
Yeah.
In the movie.
In the movie.
Goes like, up to the.
During the pandemic, my dad and I, we finished our basement, my basement. So he'd come over, we would finish
we
my basement.
We, in quotes.
Yeah, and I say we, because at the end of it, he was like, now how do you, like, isn't this cool? Like, you did this, like, this is great. I was like, I'm five. Like, you did a nice job. And I'm like, he goes, now you know how to do all this stuff. And I'm like, No,
I don't.
I don't know how to do any of this. You just told me what to do and I did it. I don't know. If you gave me a fresh basement to redo, I couldn't do anything that we just did.
Yeah.
Not one single thing. It is crazy.
That's why there are people to call.
That's right.
Thank you, AAA.
We call dads or AAA.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, we have more to talk to. We're going to get back into some news discussions about what's going on with Steve Witkoff and the Russians at 6:49. Big meeting.
Welcome back to JR Morning. As the United States intensifies its push to bring an end to the war in Ukraine, President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is in Moscow for a high-stakes meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This comes just days after his team met with Ukrainian officials, signaling a renewed diplomatic effort from Washington to break the stalemate and chart a path toward peace. And joining us now to break down what this mission means and what to watch for is Fox News radio correspondent and WJR contributor Jonathan Savage. Jonathan, good to have you back.
Hello, nice to talk to you again.
So Steve Witkoff is in Moscow. He's meeting with Vladimir Putin. And how significant is this moment in the broader push to end the war? I mean, I'm wondering what he's taking over there that Putin will say, okay, we stop.
Yeah, that is the question. What will Vladimir Putin say? The White House says it is very optimistic about reaching a deal here to end the war in Ukraine. What Steve Witkoff is presenting to Vladimir Putin is an amended peace plan. Now, thinking back a few weeks, we had that 28-point proposal that leaked out. It was rejected by both Ukraine and its European partners because they felt it was far too weighted towards Russian demands. Then there was a meeting in Geneva led by Marco Rubio from the United States, and they changed that peace plan significantly. And then at the weekend in Florida, another meeting between Americans and Ukrainians, and they've come up with what is being described as a refined framework peace agreement. That is what is going to be presented to Vladimir Putin. Now, the thing is, in public, Vladimir Putin has not given up on any of his maximalist demands for ending the war in Ukraine. He will expect Ukraine to make territorial concessions. He does not want Ukraine to have any path to NATO membership. We don't know what precisely is in this new proposal. And of course, the answer as to whether Russia will agree to it will depend on those contents.
And, you know, there's discussion if this should be sort of Marco Rubio's job. But Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner did get the job done in Gaza. And I think they have a lot of political will because of that.
Yeah, Marco Rubio is more of a hawk on Russia than perhaps Steve Witkoff is seen as being. And Marco Rubio says the aim of the talks that he's had with the Ukrainians is to leave Ukraine sovereign, independent and prosperous. Now, Steve Witkoff has now visited Russia six times in the year 2025. He has not been to Kyiv. In fact, it was the Army Secretary Dan Driscoll who presented plans to the Ukrainians in Kyiv rather than the Defense Secretary or Steve Witkoff or even Marco Rubio. So there's a number of different American players who are playing part in this right now. Steve Witkoff perhaps less trusted by the Ukrainians. They don't necessarily see him as someone who has their interests at heart. He's not got much diplomatic experience before joining the Trump administration. And I think the skepticism over Steve Witkoff in Ukraine will be added to by the reports in the Wall Street Journal last week that he's looking at business proposals with Russia alongside peace plans.
The European Union Commissioner for Justice and Democracy, Michael McGrath, said that it is imperative that this deal not hold full amnesty for Vladimir Putin for potential war crimes committed during this conflict. Is that on the table here? And what would the fallout of that be, do you think?
We haven't seen anything which would suggest that this is up for grabs. We do know that there are arrest warrants out against Vladimir Putin and some others in the Russian administration for alleged war crimes in Ukraine. That's partly why Vladimir Putin is not able to visit certain countries, will only travel to particular territories which don't recognize the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Of course, Vladimir Putin rejects these allegations, and it's unlikely that he will accept any jurisdiction as part of this deal. So I think that's probably going to be swept under the carpet a little bit, but Ukraine no doubt will insist on its right to declare that Vladimir Putin and Russia should be held accountable.
Speaking with Jonathan Savage, Fox News radio correspondent, WJR contributor, Zelensky has been clear, Jonathan, that surrendering territory is just off the table and that NATO membership is the best security guarantee. But with the president, President Trump, ruling out NATO membership, I mean, what realistic security alternatives exist for Ukraine? Because they want to rebuild. But, you know, if you come to a deal with Putin, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to stick with it. You need some security.
The Ukrainians point out that Russia and Vladimir Putin in particular have gone back on various agreements multiple times in the past. They know that what Vladimir Putin would like is not just a neutral NATO, which is what he has said, but a NATO which is susceptible to Russian influence. And the fear that Russia would attack again if there were no security guarantees in place. Now, the ideal guarantee for them is NATO membership and the Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which would give them protection. But they're looking for something, if that's not possible, which would give them similar protection. The idea that Western countries would come to their aid if Russia were to attack again. Now, the parameters of that would need to be set out pretty clearly, because Russia doesn't want any NATO troops on Ukrainian soil. And the parts of Ukraine which Russia claims and hopes to be able to have recognized as Russia as a result of this peace deal, if it goes through, would need to be excluded from those security guarantees. So it's something that definitely is being talked about, and Ukraine, I think, will insist upon it.
We'll keep an eye on this meeting, see what happens, and I know you'll be following it as well. Jonathan Savage, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can I lighten things up here just for a second after some heavy geopolitical talk?
Sure.
So police arrested a 50-year-old man in Bangor, Maine, who allegedly broke into an apartment, unwrapped Christmas gifts that were under the tree, and then took a nap.
He was a Grinch.
Who has their presents wrapped under the tree already?
That's and that was my first question. How in the world do you have all of your Christmas shopping not only done, but then wrapped and ready to go?
Hey, man, being proactive, getting out in front of it.
Jose Harvey was sleeping on this woman's couch. She called police. And they came and found him, and he said that they charged him for aggravated criminal trespass, but he was just wanted to come in and see what she had wrapped up under the tree.
Okay, he wasn't drunk or anything. Did they say any
that
alcohol
would be
was
so involved? Scary coming to just, your house and there's a human being sleeping on your couch?
Just this guy sitting there with unwrapped wrapping paper everywhere.
Oh, right,
just I am spent. That was some excellent shopping you did.
Yeah.
Coming up, it's the 7 o'clock hour here on JR Morning. The mayor-elect held a community engagement forum yesterday. We'll hear from her next as JR Morning continues.
Hey, make sure you stay dialed into what we're doing here on WJR, because if you ever miss a show or an interview, everything is available on our website, WJR.com, on our podcast, wherever you get your podcast. Stream us, download the app, the whole deal. You know where to find us. Also, coming up at 8:49, we've got tickets to Monty Python's Spamalot coming to the Fisher Theater January 27th through the 31st, so make sure you're sticking around for that. Lots to talk about still this morning, including the White House commenting for the first time on these boat strikes, particularly the first boat strike back in early September, when a second strike on the same boat was conducted. And the orders from the top, which was the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, that there were to be no survivors. Eliminate the threat. So they carried out one strike, took out the boat, and there were two survivors still clinging onto the wreckage, and that's when the second strike was ordered.
And Caroline Leavitt from The Podium talked about this strike.
With respect to the strikes in question on September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated.
And so they're now acknowledging that there was a second strike. Initially, Hegseth called it fake news. This is not a real story, whatever. So, yeah, there was a second strike. And now the House and the Senate Armed Services Committees are asking more questions.
Meanwhile, you've got Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner meeting with Vladimir Putin today in Russia to talk about this deal, these proposed peace ideas that the administration has been championing. And there's been acceptance to a certain degree on the Ukrainian front, but these negotiations are still going on. Europe very skeptical of this deal, and now it's going to be on Vladimir Putin. I mean, if Vladimir Putin today rubber stamps this thing and says, okay, we stop.
Yep.
I just don't believe that this is the end.
I don't think Zelensky does as well. First of all, Zelensky says, you know, we're not giving up any more land, and we have to have some type of security force because we don't believe Putin either. Because after the fact, he can come in and do anything else. NATO is off the table, but it's like, what kind of security force?
Well, I think NATO's been off the table for a while.
Yeah. So, but what do we have? Who's going to secure us to make sure that Putin doesn't try this again because we don't trust him?
I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I'm with you, Jamie. What you said earlier makes sense. I mean, you got to try. I mean, it's why I applauded the fact that he had Putin in Alaska, right? Whatever the symbolism is and the imagery and all that stuff, I don't care about. You try
but
the diplomatic
I think
approach.
Important after all the stuff he did to roll out the red carpet like that.
I agree. But at the same time, you got to do whatever you can to try to get this guy on the side of stopping these attacks.
The bottom line.
And then, but you've got Putin telling Trump that he's going to, you know, pull back the reins a little bit. And then the next day, boom, 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 boom.
On more civilian bombs. Targets.
Correct. Yeah. So it's absolutely ridiculous to accept anything that Vladimir Putin says at face value. So you try this diplomatic approach. I don't know what if the diplomatic route doesn't work, then what? I mean, what do you do?
Well, the sanction thing hasn't worked.
Nope.
And
no.
the normal channels haven't worked. So I guess, you know, to make the argument, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner were successful in Gaza. Let's see if they can come to some agreement. Mm. But will anyone believe it once it's, say, they sign it? We'll see.
Dozens of Detroit residents gathered yesterday evening at the Marigold Conservancy on the city's northwest side to share their ideas with Mayor-elect Mary Sheffield, helping shape policy, she says, will spread the city's progress to more neighborhoods. Between 60 and 70 participants engaged in some lively discussions at tables focused on issues from public safety to youth education. Residents shared ideas on everything from improving senior mobility and public transportation to expanding training programs for younger people. Sheffield emphasized the importance of actionable recommendations to guide her first 100 days in office.
They want investment. They want housing. They want safety. And so those are the things that we're going to continue to lift up as mayor. But again, I think being rooted here for the transition, again, brings attention back into the neighborhoods. And I think that's what's important about this process.
The event, part of Sheffield's Rise Higher Detroit transition team efforts, also set the stage for a citywide survey launching in January aimed at gathering input from thousands more Detroiters. Sheffield's team, made up of nearly four dozen leaders across 18 committees, will deliver a broad set of policy recommendations by the end of this year as she prepares to take office on January 1.
Excellent. And there's another person with a new job, and that is Pat Fitzgerald at Michigan State. It's official. It was rumor yesterday. Now it's official. Pat Fitzgerald, formerly of the Big Ten Northwestern, coming over to the Big Ten Spartans. There's a statement from him, quote, "I am honored to be named the head football coach at Michigan State University. I'd like to thank President Kevin Guskowitz, Athletic Director Jay Batt for this opportunity. This is a program with a deep and storied tradition, passionate fan base, commitment to excellence that extends far beyond football," and it goes on. So Michigan State will formally introduce him as the football coach on today at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, today at 3 o'clock. So we'll have more tomorrow.
I liked this hire when it was a rumor. I actually love it now. I love it.
Now that's officially official?
Yeah, no, I the more I thought about this yesterday, mm-hmm. I mean, you look at what Pat Fitzgerald did at Northwestern, and this is not, I'm not, you know, the academic standards at Northwestern are very rigorous. The bar is very high. So when you're looking for players that can, it's like Stanford. right? It's like some of these elite institutions that when you're talking about athletes, you know, they're focused on athletics a lot of times. Ask what's his name, the former quarterback at Ohio State, Cardale Jones.
Not Cardale Jones.
We're not here to play school, right? Yeah, so that's the mentality for a lot of these college football players. But Pat Fitzgerald did more with quote unquote less talent because of the high academic standards. I mean, I think he's going to do a wonderful job at Michigan State.
He was 110-101 overall, but he won 10 games three times at that program, and that's a big deal.
It's a big deal. 7:12, time for WJR's Business, be brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here is Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Young people are facing a really tough job market these days, to be sure. However, in spite of the tough sledding to get and keep a job these days, as CNBC reports, there's some good news on the horizon for 2026, as new grads with up to 4 years of work experience are expected to see stronger wage growth next year, according to Glassdoor Research. Now, this wage growth, while generally national in nature, is different from market to market. Cities on the rise are projected to offer the biggest growth in wages, all while offering a lower cost of living, Glassdoor Research notes. So what are the hottest sectors based on wage growth for young workers as we head into 2026? Well, healthcare jobs are the most in-demand roles with rising pay for young workers, Glassdoor lead researcher Chris Martin told CNBC Make It. Another hot sector, private education jobs. Overall, healthcare, along with those private education jobs, have propped up the economy for some time. They make up about 17% of the jobs nationally, but accounted for 56% of job growth between July 2023 and July 2025. That according to Indeed analysis of Bureau and Labor Statistics data. Other hot job sectors include customer services and support roles. And while those sectors are hot, some cities are projected to offer rising wages across the income spectrum. And here are those top 10 cities for early career wage growth, according to Glassdoor Research. At number 10, it's Tucson, Arizona. Number 9, Richmond, Virginia. At number 8, Denver, Colorado. Then at 7, Rochester, New York. Next, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Then the top 5, Austin, Texas at 5. Charleston, South Carolina at 4. Orlando, Florida at 3. Boise, Idaho at 2. And Provo, Utah comes in number 1 for projected job wage growth in 2026. So there you have it. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Welcome back to JR Morning. We're going to get into some legalese and legal issues with Barb McQuaid, law professor at University of Michigan and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Good morning, Barb.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
The latest in this saga of U.S. attorneys around the country is that Alina Haba has been serving unlawfully as the U.S. attorney in New Jersey. That, according to a federal appeals court. Why did the court rule that way? What did they say?
Well, what essentially the court said is that the appointment of Haba in ways that are not already provided by the Constitution and by federal statute was invalid. You know, ordinarily, U.S. attorneys must be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. I went through that process myself. But there are some other ways to fill vacancies on a short-term basis. If you've got a vacancy and you want to fill it with a temporary person. And the Trump administration has tried to do that. First, they appointed Lindsey Halligan as the interim U.S. attorney. That's for a duration of only 120 days by statute. After that, it's the court that gets to fill a vacancy. And the court did choose someone else. Pam Bondi, the attorney general, promptly fired that other person and then tried to find a different way to circumvent the law to install Alina Haba. She appointed her a special attorney and then the first assistant U.S. attorney and then the acting U.S. attorney. But what the court said is you can't circumvent the law to get your person there. There are kind of three ways you can appoint a U.S. attorney, and they didn't use any of them.
Well, three criminal defendants argue that Haba's invalid appointment should lead to their cases being dismissed, and the lower court refused. So what does this ruling mean for, like, ongoing and past cases that she handled?
Yes. You know, it's really an interesting question because this is very different from what we saw in the Eastern District of Virginia, where Lindsey Halligan indicted the cases of James Comey and Letitia James, and those cases were invalidated. And that is because the court there said she was the only attorney to sign the indictment and to appear in the grand jury room. And therefore, under the law that requires an attorney for the government to be present, since she was improperly appointed, there was no attorney for the government signing off on these indictments, and therefore they were invalid. That wasn't the case in New Jersey. In New Jersey, there were assistant U.S. attorneys who signed the documents, who appeared in the court. And so what the lower court said below and was not even an issue on appeal was that even her, though her appointment is invalid, the indictments that were returned by other prosecutors in the office are valid. But what I think it means is that she may no longer serve as the U.S. attorney there. They may keep her in place and give her a different sort of title. But in terms of acting as the chief law enforcement officer of that district, she is not to be recognized as such.
What are the side effects of a district, of a community who doesn't have that position in place? I imagine continuity has to be pretty important. Obviously, these bigger cases make the headlines, but there's a lot of work that gets done day to day that I imagine the continuity would be beneficial.
Yes, you know, the U.S. attorney plays a role of supervising the office, but also leading the law enforcement community in that district. One of the things, you know, with regard to the local office of the FBI, of the Drug Enforcement Administration, of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that U.S. attorney is directing priorities for all of those agencies. And if you don't have a person in that position, then there's really nobody to sort of coordinate all of those efforts. Everybody's kind of just doing their own thing. U.S. attorneys' offices can get along for a while with acting U.S. attorneys, sometimes quite well if it is a person who has been in the office for a long time, has experience and institutional knowledge. But of course, Lena Hubba doesn't have those things. And so I imagine that for that office, it feels quite unsettled to be working in that office without a presidentially appointed and Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney or someone who's been there a long time and has that institutional knowledge.
Well, and the judges wrote in their decision that the citizens of New Jersey and the loyal employees in the U.S. attorney's office deserve some clarity and stability. So there's agreement there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point that the court was making there, is that if you've got, you know, kind of musical chairs at the U.S. attorney's position, and, you know, the firing of a first assistant who was someone who was an experienced and respected member of that office, it does leave people wondering who's in charge. And without a leader, it's also difficult to do the day-to-day management of the office, who is being assigned to cases, who is being hired, who is being promoted, who is filling the middle management positions. And so there is likely some chaos going on in that office, and one hopes that the administration would find someone, certainly someone who's their preference, but someone who is can be nominated and confirmed by the Senate to serve in the permanent role for the duration of the Trump administration.
Well, we knew you would have the answers here as a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan yourself. Thank you, Barb McQuaid.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be with you.
We appreciate it. Yeah.
And then you get, but this, then you start to step in the political pie.
Uh-huh.
Right, because you know you need the senators in those states to okay these candidates,
yep,
to then get to the full Senate for approval, but you know this is a blue state, and now you're dealing with the Trump administration, and they're not going to want to approve anybody that the Trump administration is going to put forth. We've
possibly
seen that here in the state of Michigan.
But when you use the personal attorneys who don't have the background, then you're going to get even more pushback. If you pick career prosecutors, possibly you would have a different.
I mean, I think it was Tom Leonard who was up for one of these positions, and they weren't able to get the approval of our senators here in the state of Michigan. So it is then you get into the political game of it all, and
you
then
do.
It's the people in these jurisdictions that suffer.
But don't
it
you
is.
Have to follow the rules? Otherwise, anyone could put anyone they wanted in.
Well, yes, but then it leads to okay. So then, what are you going to do? You're just going to have an interim U.S. attorney
forever,
every 120 days.
Yeah.
No, because you can't have two back-to-back.
Right, so
that's what they said in the other case,
right,
the Lindsay Halligan.
So you're just going to appoint somebody else, and then somebody else, and then somebody else, and then somebody else. It just you're just kicking the can down the road when it just feels like it's you're not carrying out what needs to be carried out in these communities.
And for those lawyers who work for these offices, you know, not to have, you know, some leadership and some guidance, you know, that's consistent. That's
yeah,
not
all
good
the work
either.
They, like she said, with all the other institutions in the area, FBI,
yeah,
ATF, things like that.
Have you ever had an MRI?
I have not.
Have you?
I have.
Do you know what part of your body you're getting the MRI?
Usually they ask me. You know, they kind of question. They say, Mr. Jackson, we're going to do an MRI on such and such a spot in your body, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, put you in that tube. And, you know, sometimes they offer you some medication if you can't deal with it. If you're claustrophobic, I'm good. Just give me, you know, some music or something and I'm fine.
Well, maybe the president wasn't quite sure why he had the MRI because it was preventative. Doctors say the president had the MRI on his heart and abdomen in October as part of a preventative screening for men of his age. And they said, the doctor said that everything's fine, perfectly normal for the president.
He didn't know, though, what they were doing. He didn't know what type of MRI.
Right. He was on the plane. Him. That's when they asked him. He's like, I don't know. I know it wasn't my brain.
I imagine if I were to get an MRI, they're like, you need this on your leg? I'm like, yeah. They're like, how about we do your head too? Because there are some problems up there. Take a break. More next.
When I say the ultimate mix of endurance and spice, what do you think?
I have no idea.
No.
Not a clue.
Mm-mm.
This is a fantastic story in the Washington Post, and it is about an ultra marathon, which is 31 miles, which tacks onto it a challenge. And in this case, eating at 9 Taco Bells, also part of this challenge. The story starts with, sure, vomiting is allowed, discouraged, but allowed, according to this ultra marathon. 31 miles
you
of running.
You sold me.
Several thousand calories of greasy fast food for this event. It's the Taco Bell DC 50K. And it was the first ever of this event. And it's pretty exciting. Each participant had to run to 9 Taco Bells scattered across Alexandria, Arlington, and the District of Columbia. At each location, they must purchase and eat an item off the menu. Drinks don't count.
It can't be the same item?
You're not allowed to just get like a soft taco at every stop because there are rules. By the fourth Taco Bell, they had to have eaten a Chalupa Supreme or a Crunchwrap Supreme. By the eighth stop, they must have downed a Burrito Supreme or a Nachos Bel Grande. And they have to give their receipts at the finish line. And they have 11 hours to complete this course.
Oh, my goodness.
So this has already happened. It happened in Washington, D.C. area. And I think it's hilarious.
Is it porta potties along the route?
That is not included in this article, Lloyd, but I hope so.
Well, if you could throw up and at least be able to do that, too.
All right, so I feel like you have to be a very specific person for this ultra marathon. Because if you get a real... if you
baseline
get a,
running that far, now this is 31 miles?
Correct.
That's like, tough.
Like, I understand you running, you know, a marathon. I mean, when you run a marathon, you got to train. I mean, and train and train and train, and you're running every day. You're running, you know, 100-plus
right.
miles every month
ready.
To prep for it.
Yes.
Usually... and I guess, I don't know, I haven't done it, but usually that doesn't include a steady diet of Taco Bell
no.
in your
right.
training. So I feel like you got to be a very, this is a very specific person that's running this thing that can have the
so how do you
the
train?
Stomach, the endurance to.
Yeah. How do you train? Do you go to some Taco Bells, buy some things, and then you start
yeah,
running?
You run
and then,
to Taco Bell.
And then I understand that, but I'm just saying you got to eat, though, when you go to these Taco Bells.
Right.
So do you go, while you're training, do
yeah.
you go to some Taco Bells, grab some different types of food there, and then you run, and then you just, you know, eat a Taco Bell
yeah.
thing while you're running?
It seems like that's what you'd have to do.
Yeah.
To train.
I think these people are just runners. And then they just are hoping they make it through this Taco Bell challenge. This was started by two friends who are these ultra runner folks. You know, they do these ultra marathons all over the country, all over the world. And they thought this would be fun in D.C. They thought like 100 people would come out. 1,000 people came out. And, yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, you got Taco Bell. Who knows? You want to get a marathon down for McDonald's and Wendy's and all.
Did you ever see The Office episode where Michael Scott started a 5K for somebody in the office because they contracted rabies? And he thought it was this unknown deadly disease. And before the race starts, he carbo loads by eating chicken Alfredo.
Oh,
and he's
Lord.
Running through the race and he's like, it's just a rock in my stomach. That's just how I imagine this would be. Like, this is a terrible. You get to the first Taco Bell, you're like, this is a bad idea.
Well,
that's not for me.
My son wouldn't run for nothing, but for this.
But maybe for the Taco
Bell.
If I tell him this, he'll be like, Dad, yes.
He's like, I'm going to D.C. next year. We're going to do it. Oxford Dictionary has released their word of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually two words. It's rage bait. Rage bait.
Do you know what that is? That is when you deliberately say something or do something online that you know it will elicit a reaction from people, that people are going to get really mad.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, that happens a lot.
It's all over the place. I don't know if it's 2025. I guess, that is.
Yeah.
That's necessarily, I mean, I think this has been happening for years.
Uh-huh.
But I think
more
the president
so
does this.
Yes.
He knows, you know, when he makes those AI videos of all the things, that he knows it's going to elicit a reaction.
Yes. Yeah, I think this is very popular in sports as well, in the sports fandom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got, you know, fans of other teams that are just throwing stuff out there to make the rivals mad or you know, the Bears mad or whatever. They're just throwing stuff out there. Rage bait. I think it's apropos, but I don't know that this is unique to 2025. It feels like this has been around for some time.
It does. It doesn't seem new, but, you know, whatever. Do your thing, Oxford.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Speaking of the sports world, big signing at Michigan State. They did it. It's Pat Fitzgerald. It was the rumor yesterday when we were on our show, and now it's official, and they're going to announce him later on today. He said he's honored to come to Michigan State. It's got a storied tradition. He thinks it's a great opportunity, and he's obviously been lying in wait, waiting for an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Here it is, and it sure seems like Jay Batt had this all set up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Jonathan Smith knew when he won that final game or not, but here we are.
Quick. It was
new era.
Pretty fast.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Jonathan Smith said at the post-game press conference after that game in Michigan or at Ford Field, he's like, you know, we got to do better. I'm going to talk with Jay, you know, this week or whatever. So I guess I don't know if he knew. It didn't feel like he knew.
Uh-uh.
But I actually like the fact that they didn't go, well, we're going to form a search committee. We're going to go out
in
that whole dog and pony show.
Right. Yeah.
They went out and they go, we know who we want. We're going to go get them.
Yep.
And it does feel like there were conversations maybe even during the season. Because this was, I mean, the news of the Jonathan Smith firing broke, and then immediately it was the rumors of Pat Fitzgerald.
Exactly.
Fitzgerald's 51 years old. It's the oldest football coach hired by Michigan State since its November 2006 hiring of Mark D'Antonio. And that was the glory days of Michigan State football. And so obviously they're hoping that they can repeat that.
I mean, I think that this is the guy to do it. I mean, he is a darn good football coach.
Mm-hmm.
Darn good football coach. So I think it's great for Michigan State. I think this is, again, there is no, like, holding pattern, right, while we search for a new coach. You got your guy. That way you can talk to your players.
Yeah.
You can try to keep people, which is a huge aspect in this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, retaining some of the guys that you really like on this roster that are going to be, you know, potentially good for the future. So, you know, keeping a roster together, too, is a big part of this. All right, we'll take a break. On the other side, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan will join us. Big news yesterday on the Packer plant, so we're excited to talk with him. Meanwhile, we want you to help us because it is a wonderful tradition here at WJR. It's WJR's Christmas on Us, and it's our way to honor the dedication and the sacrifice of Michigan's active military families and veterans. They make sacrifices 365 all year long, and they help us ensure that we have a truly joyful Christmas. So if you know a deserving family who serves our country, we want you to nominate them now at WJR.com. On the other side, we've got Mayor Mike Duggan. It's JR Morning.
Who wants to go to Europe with me next year, 2026? Get ready to savor Southern Italy and indulge in its bold flavors, vintage wines, and timeless beauty. Come with me, Jamie Edmonds, for this unparalleled experience, October 10th through the 15th, as we take a journey through the senses, through Puglia, private tours of the ancient towns of Matera, Abel Rubello. We'll behold the iconic stone Truly Houses, and so much more. All of this with an acclaimed chef, too. Michelle Bomarito, she's coming. And John Filone, co-owner of Cantoro Italian Market and Trattoria, he's coming. We'll enjoy authentic local dishes, wine tasting, pasta making, and breathtaking legendary landmarks. Space is limited. Join my husband and me for our 10-year anniversary next October. Ryan's coming too. Visit exceptionaljourneys.net or call 1-855-305-8982. That's 1-855-305-8982. Italy awaits us.
Welcome back to JR Morning as we await Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, who yesterday announced that the city has signed a letter of intent for a seasoned developer to reactivate 28 acres of the former Packard plant, including that historic Albert Kahn designed building on West Grand Boulevard. The project is going to be called Packard Park. It's going to have like a skate park in it. It's going to be some affordable housing. It looks good looking at the renderings, guys. And it's an eyesore that really needed to be taken care of. It's been vacant. I believe the Packard plant has been vacant since like 1956. So it's a long time eyesore here in the city of Detroit.
I like what the mayor said yesterday about the facade facing the boulevard.
Yes.
That's going to stay, which I think is very cool.
Yeah.
Because I think that's kind of become its own, you know, landmark.
It has been, yeah.
In the city. So I think it's cool that they're going to keep that while, you know, upgrading it and making it a wonderful space.
Yeah.
This has been ongoing for a long time, and there have been plans that have come and gone.
Yes.
But it does seem like this definitely has some momentum. And part of the step one was getting rid of the blight and some of the, you know, all the stuff that was left. And it seems like that part's done. So they're in a good spot.
They are really in a good spot. I mean, the city, that was one of the pieces of land and some property that really was another eyesore in the city, like the train station was for a long time. People, you know, when they talked about Detroit, the first thing you saw on a magazine or a newspaper was the train station. The Packard plant was like that as well. Those two are now going to be taken care of, and, you know, the city's on a roll right now. City's on a roll.
Another thing that we've been waiting on is the Rensen, and they said that the last food court restaurant at the Renaissance Center closed.
Was that Burger King?
It was the Burger King the lower level of the building.
Know about
That's out of there. It must look like a ghost town in there.
Ghost town.
It's got to be. I mean, because I've been in there since, you know, when Burger King was the only restaurant working, and it was a ghost town. So now I know it's a ghost town.
But when it was, like, bumping, McDonald's, Panera, Potbelly, Coney Island.
Yep.
Yes. But I never could find my way through that place. They tried to change it around. You know, it was like a fortress in
there. It is a fortress.
And you would just get lost in there, and it just never. They tried to do some things to try to make it better, but you just could never find your way through the Renaissance Center.
I was there once. My dad worked at the Renaissance Center, so he I don't know why we went one day into work with him and walking us around. And
take your kids to work day, maybe.
Yeah, I was a little older, so I mean, I don't know exactly
last week
the circumstances around it. But I remember he's like, you got to see where all the food is.
Yeah.
I mean, it was shoulder to shoulder. You couldn't move in that place.
No.
There were so many people.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I mean, it looked like a mall. It looked like a food court in a mall down there.
It did.
It was absolutely crazy. But you got to give Mike Duggan a lot of credit because, you know, he's running for governor. He's doing that whole deal. Which is a lot of work, by the way.
Yeah.
And he's still, you know, working on deals like this for the city. He has not mailed it in. He has not taken his eye off the ball.
No.
And he is in, you know, the final stages of his mayorship here.
And that's just not like him.
It's not.
He's not a coaster.
It's
you know?
Not. No, I'm not. And I'm not implying it is.
No.
I just mean that we're very lucky to have Mike Duggan as the mayor of the city of Detroit.
Yeah. And, I mean, when you think about it, and I've always said this. I've watched his State of the City addresses from the time he got in to this last one. And I think if you took those, you could make a really good documentary about the city of Detroit, because the things he said in those State of the City speeches, he did. It came to fruition. And you could really do a nice documentary on the comeback of the city of Detroit using those State of the City addresses.
Well, as we await the mayor, his team's still trying to find him. Why don't we talk a little Lions?
Oh, let's do that.
How about the state of the Lions? They're in trouble here. Anthony Bellino, our guy who does sports rap with Lomas Brown, he had an interesting comparison for golf. In 2024, when they were really good, the record was awesome, right? Through 12 games, Goff was 71.8% completion percentage, 2,900 and change yards, 22 TDs, 9 interceptions. This year, 69.8% completions. That's the same. 3,025 yards. That's about the same. 25 touchdowns. That's about the same with fewer interceptions. So yeah. Goff's performance is pretty similar to last year when they were 11-1 and now they're 7-5. And Aiden Hutchinson talked yesterday, and he just talked about what they need to do moving forward.
I mean, look, we have 5 games left for the regular season, I believe, and we're at a point where it is, you know, there's some adversity for sure. And, you know, we call ourselves a gritty team. It's all over this building. It's what people say about us. But I think it's easy to be gritty when you're winning games and it's all sunshine and rainbows. But in these moments, you know, when you're coming off a bad loss to a divisional opponent on Thanksgiving, it's just obviously none of us want that result. How can we come together and still make this season worthy of being remembered?
To Anthony's point, what has changed is the offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jared Goff is not a mobile quarterback. Jared Goff is
has much fewer time to make a decision.
Correct.
Right.
But his numbers are about the same. Now, it's not broken down to the past like 3 games, though.
Correct. Again, and this is a league of what have you done for me lately?
Lately, yeah.
Lately, not much. Not much. And to that point, over the last 3 games, Amon-Ra St. Brown has dropped passes. Mm-hmm. That's unusual. You know, you don't have Sam Laporta. That's a safety valve that's gone. So the numbers might still be the same, but the look is totally different. I mean, he just is not, he's not a guy that can get on the move like that. He is very much a pocket passer. And when the pocket is collapsing around him almost every offensive snap, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
Oh, and, you know, here come the Cowboys on Thursday night. They're on the up.
On the up,
They're trending upward. The Lions, not so much. So, you know, Thursday's make or break.
Yeah, Thursday's make or break.
Yeah.
It's a must win.
I think so. And I think, you know, really, you need to win out, I believe.
I mean, you need to have a shot.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
You need to win out. And then you're going to need to rely on some others. And other teams losing. And
yeah.
True, yeah.
I'm going to do Sports Wrap with Steve Courtney on Thursday night. So that'll be fun.
Well, that'll be
back
that'll
to
be
the
fun.
Roots.
Back to the roots with Courtney.
Yeah.
All right.
Very good. When is that?
This Thursday.
Oh, Thursday.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Good.
Coming up, the 8 o'clock hour of JR Morning, prosecutors are asking the court to dismiss that appeal by the ex-Riverfront CFO. That's coming up.
8:05, good to have you this Tuesday morning. You know, the White House responded yesterday to these allegations. This stemmed from a Washington Post report initially. They had it first, that there was actually a second strike on the first boat that they targeted in the Caribbean, these drug runner boats, and that there was a second strike carried out. It was carried out by Admiral Frank Bradley, who ordered that second strike, but that was in compliance with Pete Hegseth's directive,
right?
Which was eliminate
the
enemy,
mm-hmm.
stop the threat.
Mm-hmm.
And it took 2 hits, 2 strikes to eliminate the threat, which was the first one hit the boat, took it out. But there were 2 survivors of that initial strike, so they carried out a second strike and eliminated that threat, according to the Pentagon. So it now leaves this question of, was that a lawful order? Should that have been carried out? Is that a violation of war, international laws? And now that's in the spotlight once again.
The initial report was that there were these 2 strikes. It killed the survivors the second time, the remaining 2, and that it shouldn't have been done because it could have been a war crime. Hegseth came out and said that's not true. It's fake news. Now it's Caroline Leavitt at the podium saying, well, yes, that did happen, but this was totally legal.
With respect to the strikes in question on September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated.
So if there are 2 people clinging to floating debris, what is the threat to the United States of America?
Well, I guess in their mind, you know, you let them go, they get back to where they came from some kind of way and do it again.
go pick them up. Talk to them about the drug smuggling. Who hired you? How did this work?
Right. Now, my guess is they would have a lot of that information.
But
at the end of the day, I still would want questions answered. You know, if you got somebody, you can go pick them up.
Yeah. Right,
to your point. Go pick them up and then use them as informants. Flip them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right?
You could.
And then maybe you get more answers. To me, the information gathering process in that case would have been maybe valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you need to prosecute them or you need to do what you need to do, that's a totally different,
right.
You know, now we're in a completely different track.
Right.
So, and there's been so many of these at this point.
There have been 21 strikes killing 83 people.
Right. So they blend together, right? Things are starting to, you start to forget about some that they've done. And this is, and then this ties in, of course, with the video that these Democratic lawmakers put out about illegal military orders.
Well, the president said that he wouldn't have done the second strike.
Correct.
But then he said, I
have full faith in Pete Hegseth and the job he's doing.
So just basically, you know, we just turn that loose. And when it's come to those types of things, he doesn't need to be involved.
I'm wondering how long is Secretary of War Hegseth going to, you know, remain? Because he seems to be embroiled in a lot of scandals here or there, but he survives. They continue to have the, you know,
the president
faith in him.
As long as he has the president's backing,
right.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you've got Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner in Moscow talking to Vladimir Putin on this, you know, 28-point peace plan that has been put together to stop the fighting between Russia and Ukraine. And I just have a really hard time if they go, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner to Vladimir Putin, go, here's what we need. Here's what you got to do. If you get this, you get this land, you do this, and away we go. We don't have to do this anymore. And Vladimir Putin goes, okay, yeah, that's great. I don't have any faith that this is long-lasting. I don't have any faith in really anything Vladimir Putin says at this point.
But Zelensky doesn't either, and that's why he wants some type of security force or something there, you know, if a deal is done, because what's going to keep Putin from trying this again down the line? Because he doesn't trust him.
I mean, Crimea was 2014,
mm-hmm.
So.
Not that long ago.
Correct.
Right. Federal prosecutors in Detroit are asking a federal appeals court to dismiss the appeal of former Detroit Riverfront Conservancy CFO William Smith. He is serving a 19-year sentence for embezzling more than $44 million from the nonprofit. Smith's attorney filed the appeal in November, arguing that his sentence was too long and that multiple sentencing enhancements were improperly applied. And prosecutors countered in a filing Monday, noting that Smith pleaded guilty to wire fraud and money laundering and agreed in his plea deal to waive the right to appeal any sentence under 235 months. The 53-year-old Smith was sentenced in April following an 11-year embezzlement scheme. Prosecutors emphasized that the district court carefully reviewed the plea agreement with Smith, confirming he understood that his appeal rights were waived. The government says the appeal should be dismissed, citing the binding terms of Smith's plea agreement.
And he got less than that?
He got less than the 235
right.
months. They said, you can't plea this out if you get less than 235
so
months.
So what are we doing here?
So it's like we're...
You know in football when they don't call the pass interference because the ball's uncatchable?
Right.
This appeal's uncatchable. It's like a non-starter.
I don't even understand what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. You know, you got to throw something on the wall.
Feels like a waste.
You don't
want
to be in jail for, you know, 19 years.
Yeah,
so
I'm
trying
to
do whatever you got to do,
that's
I guess.
Fine, but feels like you're wasting a lot of time here.
Yeah, you are.
This is sort of breaking right now that Michael and Susan Dell are going to put $250 in 25 million children's accounts. This is a tech billionaire and his wife trying to, you know, do some philanthropy here. They say that they will deposit this $250 in individual investment accounts for 25 million children, amount totaling $6+ billion. It's one of the biggest philanthropic gifts ever to go directly to Americans. And this is along the lines of this idea of Trump accounts, that the money expands the number of children who receive the seed money in these investment accounts. The federal government will give $1,000 to babies born between January 1st, 2025, December 31st, 2028. The Dell's gift extends to children up to 10 years old.
Well, I've got a couple routing numbers for him that I'd like to make him aware of. Oh, that's
well,
pretty cool.
Here's the eligibility. Those who live in a zip code where the median household income is below $150,000. details of these accounts from the federal government haven't been revealed yet. They're supposed to be set up next summer. But Mr. Dell is saying, like, he hopes other big people with big money can do this because it sets kids up for the future.
I guess my question is, how does he have access to this, like the infrastructure to make something like this happen?
From what I'm reading here, that's not figured out yet.
Right.
But he wants to give this money.
Sounds like a nice little PR kiss before the holidays.
Devil's in the details.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, that's great. I think even the idea of what Donald Trump was posing, I think is on its face a really good idea. I just don't know how that works. I don't know, you know, from a government perspective,
right.
I don't know how that works.
Right, exactly.
And here, the nuts and bolts of it. I'm just I'm not joking.
They don't know either. So
I mean, I feel pretty good giving that information out because I don't think he's gonna
take
money. I think he's do you have any Olivia?
She was not born during those dates.
Up to 10 though, right?
But she was not born during those dates.
It's
January 1st through 2025 through December 31st, 2028.
Oh, well, then we're definitely out of the running.
Nope, well, we're out.
That's
my
unfortunate.
Grandkids, yep, none of them can't do it. Nope.
All right, we'll take a break. What is the immigration implications on the shooter of the National Guard in Washington, D.C.? We'll talk to Reggie Passas, the attorney at Butzel Long Necks, here on JR Morning.
Welcome back to JR Morning. We've been talking about, in the wake of the shooting of those two National Guardsmen in Guardsman and Woman in Washington, D.C., the reaction of this administration. Within days, they paused all asylum decisions for migrants currently in the United States. They are reviewing green cards that allow people from 19 countries to work permanently here. They're reassessing the asylum approvals issued during the Biden administration and much more. Let's bring in Reggie Passas, an attorney at Butzel Law. You specialize in immigration law. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Jamie. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So, you know, the president has made it his mission to stop the border crossings, and that has been done. Now it seems like they're using this shooting to sort of redesign immigration here in our country. Do you think it's possible?
Do I think it's possible that they can redesign the immigration coming to the country?
All of these things, it just seems hard since we're talking about like 1.5 million people.
Yeah, it's definitely a pretty big task. However, they, I mean, as you mentioned in your summary, they have taken those actions. They've also suspended naturalization oath ceremonies for persons from those countries as well. So it is having an impact. Now, the question will be, what happens now? First of all, I do know that there's still an investigation going on regarding the Afghani person who attacked those guardsmen and killed one of them, which is tragic. And, you know, so more details will probably come out that way. But you have to remember, too, one of the big things that they make a concern about is that security background checks, whether they were done properly and all that stuff. And what people have to understand is a security background check is a look back in time. It's not a look forward. I mean, I'm dating myself here, but it's not like the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report where you can have certain telepaths predict the future. They're only looking back. So unless they're going to create different touch points where security can possibly get at different areas where, which might have caused other factors, which might have caused the actual shooting, if they focus only on the immigration piece, it's going to be a difficult haul to do that. The other thing, too, it's hauling in a bunch of innocent people who have nothing to do with this and already on a taxed immigration system, which is suffering significant backlogs already. So this is just going to only add to the backlog. And, you know, my concern, my main concern with security is that, you know, security is kind of like finding a needle in the haystack when you're trying to find that bad actor. And when you increase the size of the haystack, it makes it all that much harder to find the needle. So I'm not sure if this is going to have the effect that's intended, if the effect is to make security paramount in our country right now. So, but it is going to have an impact on immigration, at least temporarily. The other thing is, what happens now? Will there be lawsuits that are involved and entailed in this? However, national security is certainly a good reason for the government to take action. So we'll have to see how this all plays out.
An attorney, you know, some immigration attorneys are urging calm. They're saying that this is still a nation of laws and that, you know, status comes with rights. But uncertainty is clearly growing in a lot of communities. What are you hearing from your clients right now?
Well, my clients right now have been a lot of them have been applying for naturalization ceremony or naturalization applications, and a lot of them are trying to get their green cards with their relatives and loved ones and key workers to come in the United States. And, you know, whether they're individuals who are sponsoring family members or employers, they are all very concerned about what's going on with the immigration as a whole. And this is just another I was going to say brick in the wall, so to speak, referencing a Pink Floyd reference, but, you know, also the immigration thing. This is just another issue that's just going to make it difficult for immigration as a whole. So they're very concerned about this. I mean, you know, they're worried about, you know, whether they can go out, whether they can, you know, I'm getting a lot of calls from employers. Can I employ this person? Are they work authorized? Are they, is there going to be an issue? Their pending green card. Can they travel for business? Can they come in, you know, in the United States? Are they have problems because of the fact that they've got a pending green card? You know, all sorts of things, the whole panoply of issues. Now, these were always concerns before. However, this has just escalated tenfold under the current approach to immigration.
A Minority Report reference and a Pink Floyd reference. That is well done by me this morning. Very well done.
I am dating myself, I realize. Yeah. Get into the Stranger Things if you want.
Right. In terms of what needs to be done overall, we've heard for years and years that the immigration reforms necessary here in the United States need to come, but they haven't. So I guess what are the overarching changes that need to be made in order to stop something like this from happening?
Oh, to stop? Well, I mean, you know, the thing is, something like this happens where people are hurt. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. Immigration is one touching point where the government has in its tools of arsenal to try and check the backgrounds of everyone to make sure people, you know, people are the people who are here, the people who we want here. However, you know, there were other instances. Again, you know, there are other instances. And I'm going to start to sound a little political, but I mean, it wasn't just an immigrant who shot someone. There was also a gun. There was also a travel pattern. I mean, the Immigration Service, you're required to report all your social media mm-hmm. On your visa applications when you come to the United States. So the U.S. does have access to be able to search your social media. Now, whether they do or not, I can't say. I mean, but they do have access. You're supposed to disclose under penalty of perjury on your visa application. So they have those tools. But again, that's only one touching point for security. You know, I'm going outside of my area of expertise in terms of talking about guns. But I mean, is there a check on that? I mean, did they run the security background check on who's able to purchase a gun, or how did this person get a weapon? This person supposedly traveled across the country. I mean, you know, things like that. And there were apparent from the media that I've read, there are warning signs that the refugee organization was trying to, you know, help this person out, and he was having a mental health issue. Was mm-hmm. there a touching point on that? So you got to look at the whole totality of the circumstances for something like this to happen in order to try and address it. And if you just look at one lens, one window, I'm afraid you're going to miss a whole other opportunity. It's kind of like, you know, when you're driving a car, you're driving a car only looking at one window. You can't
right.
do that. You
gotta, right.
You know, the whole windshield cleared up.
Right. So. It's the whole picture. Reggie Passis, attorney at Butzel, thank you so much for your insight today.
No problem. Thank you.
I think the problem with a lot of this is it's subjective. Like the president posting on social media that he threaten this trip citizenship from naturalized U.S. citizens who, quote, undermine domestic tranquility. Like, how do you define that?
Right.
You know, so those are the things that could be tough here. Mm.
So we're going to have the mayor on. He's going to come back.
Here.
We found him.
Okay.
We're going to have the mayor. And we're also going to have Paul W. Smith on as well, because Paul received a really big surprise yesterday from the mayor. So we got to talk to him about that and about the Packard plant as well. That's all coming up.
Can't wait.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited about it. Paul's our guy. We got to give him his props when he deserves it. In this case, he really does. So Paul and the mayor next on JR Morning.
Well, Detroit is taking a major step toward transforming one of its most iconic and blighted sites. Mayor Mike Duggan announcing yesterday that the city has signed a letter of intent with a seasoned developer to reactivate 28 acres of the former Packard plant, including a historic Albert Kahn design building on West Grand Boulevard. The project will be called Packard Park. And after that announcement, the mayor headed down to the Fisher Building to present WJR's Paul W. Smith with a key to the city. And joining us to talk more about that is the mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan. Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, now, first things first, yesterday you presented Paul W. with the key to the city. Paul's on with us right now. Talk about what made this
a
right moment.
I thought they were going to name it the Paul W. Smith Park.
listen, Paul.
You woke me up for this.
You got the key instead.
But Mr. Mayor, I mean no disrespect, but I've had the key now for several hours, and I can't get it to open a damn thing.
I was going to ask if this is like a janitorial key. Can you just get in anywhere in the city?
The number of people who've asked to borrow that key, and I have to say I'm sorry, but I've had no luck opening anything.
It works for the Manoogian.
Well, out of respect for Dr. Sonia, I'm not even going to try.
Well, Mr. Mayor, what made this the right moment to honor Paul W., and what does that symbolize, you know, from your perspective, that key?
Well, this is my last month in office, and I get to do things that I want to do. And Paul W. Has meant so much to the city for 3 decades. And I know he's popular on the air, but I've seen how many late night charitable events he's emceed when he had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And he just means so much to this community. I just thought it was appropriate.
Paul, it was a big surprise.
I was afraid he was going to say, well, you know, he is old. why now? I got to tell you.
I gave one to Big Sean, and he's not so old. So it's all right.
Okay. You mean there's more than one key to the city? All right, anyway, listen.
Yes.
As our 75th mayor, I couldn't be more honored than to be honored by you, Mike Duggan. I've known you for years before you were mayor. You've been doing so much good for the people of Detroit and for the people of the great state of Michigan. An honor like this coming from you, I was speechless. First of all, the team, including Ann Thomas, Steve Finitari, Mike Wheeler, Jeff Marshall, my team, Mike Parsons, Daniel Mason, Rich Luzinski, they pulled off something that's very difficult with me. I was totally shocked. They had me set up for Ann Thomas getting an award from Michigan State, which she is, but it's not till April. But they told me they were going to surprise her on my show. When they turned the tables on me, I was just caught so completely off guard. And I just have to say, I've gotten a lot of wonderful accolades and awards. This is by far the biggest and best for me by my city that I came back home to. Didn't want to leave. There wasn't a full-time job available, but I came back when there was. And it's just been a love fest pretty much ever since. And I can't thank Mayor Mike Duggan and his assistant Pamela McLean enough for including me in on this kind of an honor.
Well, when you say you were speechless, he really was. He stood up, and I felt bad for the producers because you guys had dead air time. Sit back down and talk.
Well, look, the realities are there is nobody better to highlight the wonderful things about this city than Paul W. Smith. We're lucky because we get to call him a friend. We get to call him a mentor. And we're so thrilled for you, Paul. It's so well-deserving.
Well, I'm just thrilled that the mayor made this kind of a decision. One of the best things that he said it again this morning that he said yesterday, and he said, this is my last month, and I get to do the things I want to do. And that made me, Mr. Mayor, I don't know if you understand the impact of that, but that made me feel especially good about this.
Well deserved.
I will tell you something else that happened that is equally amazing to me and totally surprising. And I don't know, Mr. Mayor, if you know this or if they let you know they were doing this, but after the mayor left and after the show, Ann Thomas said, Steve Finitari wants to see you in his office. Of course, in radio, that could mean key to the city, then get fired. But it's radio, you know. So he said, go down and see Steve. I got down the hallway, and before I got there, they pulled me into the WJR conference room, and there was the staff, and they all were clapping and cheering. And then I noticed they had a sign, and it said, the WJR Paul W. Smith Conference Room. And I looked at them, and they said, we are renaming the conference room after you. And the powerful part of that is, in the 102-year history of WJR Radio, there's never been a studio, a room, anything renamed for one of us ever. And to me, that's very, well, it was very moving for me to hear that as well, to think that that is the kind of impact and that maybe they'll keep it named that long after I'm gone. In fact, I said, if I die, will you keep that up? And they laughed. And said, you're not going to die. Just
no. Well, no. We love you, Paulie. Congratulations.
Thanks, guys.
And
thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah. Wonderful stuff. We'll talk to you, Paulie. Thank you. Right.
Mr. Mayor, let's turn to the big announcement yesterday. Officially signed that letter of intent to redevelop the 28 acres of the historic Packard plant site. Boy, we've been waiting for something to happen there for a long time.
Well, it took 10 years to knock it down. And of course, we referred to it as the Packard plant, but it was 3.5 million square feet across 47 separate buildings. And particularly in the run-up to World War II, the Packard plant was the heart of the arsenal of democracy. They kept building one engine plant, tank parts plant, airplane parts plant after another in the 30s and 40s. And so it took us a decade to get it all down, but we left two of the 47 buildings standing, the two that grace Grand Boulevard. And then last year we started saying to folks, we want proposals to redevelop. And, you know, we could get a standard auto parts plant, and that wouldn't be a bad thing. But I wanted us to see if we couldn't get something that would commemorate all that had gone on there. And I think these two developers, who, you know, one of them redid the Lincoln Motors plant over by Henry Ford Hospital into beautiful living and creative space. I said, they have a history of taking manufacturing space everybody thought had to be knocked down and turning it into something really good. And I think this is in the right hands.
Well, the developers expect completion by 2029. So Mayor-elect Mary Sheffield will have to see this through. I know she will. And we thank you, Mr. Mayor, for coming on JR Morning, giving us some insight on this Packard plant and what you did for Paul W. yesterday, too. Really a good thing. Thank
Clearly,
so
it made an impact on him, Mayor.
Yeah. He does like getting awards.
He does. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Have a good day.
All right.
Coming up, it is Giving Tuesday, a great day to give. And we'll talk to Adrian Lewis, CEO and president of Forgotten Harvest, next on JR Morning.
All right, it is 8:49. Need you to be caller number 9 at 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. Get you a pair of tickets to opening night's Monty Python Spamalot at the Fisher Theater. The Tony Award-winning best musical comedy, Monty Python Spamalot, gallops into the Fisher Theater, lovingly ripped off from the Holy Grail. This show has everything that makes a great night at the theater. From flying cows to killer rabbits, British royalty to French taunters, dancing girls, rubbery shrubbery, and of course, the Lady of the Lake. For a bonus chance to win, text the keyword SPAMALOT to 800-859-0957. Official rules are at WJR.com, and tickets are also on sale at BroadwayInDetroit.com. Well, speaking of giving away, it is Giving Tuesday, and we always love checking in with the CEO and president of Forgotten Harvest, Adrian Lewis, who joins us this morning. It's great to have you back.
Good morning and happy Giving Tuesday.
Well, this is all part of our WJR Cares campaign, and we care very much for what you do and what Forgotten Harvest does to help the people in our community.
And I certainly appreciate the support. I know we at Forgotten Harvest, we've been doing our very best and very successful at it for the past 35 years. Fighting food insecurity throughout Metro Detroit. And today, we have a huge opportunity for funds to be matched and to be transferred into great food for our community. So I'm really grateful for the Rick Young Insurance and Grateful Giving Foundation. And they're going to put up $25,000. They're donating, and they're willing to match it dollar for dollar. This is a huge opportunity for us today.
And, you know, Adrian, hunger is often called the invisible crisis. What more needs to be done to ensure that that every Detroit family, metro area family, has access to nutritious meals?
That's a really great question. I'm glad you asked, because it starts with awareness. It starts with us understanding that our communities, our neighborhoods, all of them are impacted in some way by food insecurity and access to fresh, nutritious food. And if we start there, if we understand the problem, frame the problem so that we can continue to give those that are in need a hand up, so that this would basically diminish in some ways. So that is something that we at Forgotten Harvest continue to do, and we do it also by rescuing fresh surplus nutritious foods and getting them out into the community free of charge.
That was what was so amazing to me when the three of us went down there and some others from WJR to the Forgotten Harvest warehouse, where all this food comes in from Meijer or Sam's Club or what have you, and it's repurposed, but it's not, you know, old food. This is like great looking yes. produce and bread Absolutely. Products. And I just was Absolutely. So, my heart was warm that that food isn't getting wasted and then it's going to people who need it.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, there's so many opportunities that exist for food to be surplus food, fresh surplus food to be redistributed, such as we do it, and to be doing it free of charge. It definitely takes a community. I really appreciate you guys' support with volunteering, because that's a big part of us being able to get it out into the community free of charge as well. So thank you for coming out.
Yeah, and Adrian, you know, you're partnering today with Rick Young Insurance and the Grateful Giving Foundation. There's a $25,000 match. So people, if they donate today, they can actually double the contributions that they're actually making and improve the likelihood of being able to serve more people.
That is exactly right. And our goal today is to be able to raise enough money so that we can provide 1 million meals. And I know that we can do it. Thanks for your help in raising the awareness. And we need every listener to please, whatever they can, let's take advantage of this match, but also give what you can from your heart by visiting www.forgottenharvest.org.
And so people can make that contribution today. Adrian Lewis, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time as always. And all that you do at Forgotten Harvest. We've seen it firsthand, and so many in our community experience it too. God bless you for what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. And Happy Giving Tuesday again.
That's right. Happy Giving Tuesday.
And if it's not Forgotten Harvest, it could be any number
yes.
of these organizations doing good work in our community.
Yeah, so many are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So many are. And I, you know, I've told Adrian this a couple of times. I go, you know, sometime in the future, I hope you don't have to have a job here. Like,
Absolutely.
I hope that this place doesn't have to exist, because that means that food insecurity is gone. That means that people will be fed. That means that people of all ages will be able to have access to valuable, nutritious foods.
Nutritious foods.
And that's just
yes.
not the case right now. So the good news
that we have these places,
is
right?
that we have people yeah. like Adrian Lewis. We have places like Forgotten Harvest that are there to fill that void. It's wonderful what they do.
Absolutely.
And we have people who give their time and volunteer.
Absolutely. Volunteer.
Because that, you know, it couldn't get out if we didn't have the volunteers, and the volunteers play a major part as well.
And you know, the sports teams, they do their part during this season too. Mm-hmm. The Pistons are about to do something big thanks to Tom Goris. The Lions gave out turkeys and things like that to people who needed it. And I think that's great too. The sports teams have so much sway and they follow through.
And they bring people together, you know. Sports teams bring people together. And I think out there doing those types of things, it just brings you closer, you know, to the community.
On the field, I think Aiden Hutchinson is hoping the guys come together against the Cowboys on Thursday.
I mean, look, we have 5 games left for the regular season, I believe, and we're at a point where it is, you know, there's some adversity for sure. And, you know, we call ourselves a gritty team. It's all over this building. It's what people say about us. But I think it's easy to be gritty when you're winning games and it's all sunshine and rainbows. But in these moments, you know, when you're coming off a bad loss to a divisional opponent on Thanksgiving, it's just obviously none of us want that result. How can we come together and still make this season worthy of being remembered?
Hopefully it's not remembered in the wrong way.
They got a hard road to go. I mean, they still have 5 games, and these are not easy ones. They need to basically win out, really. I would think. You know?
Yeah, and they've got a couple divisional games still.
Yeah, right.
And they got the Cowboys, who are very hot this week.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have a tough road ahead, certainly. Did you see the story about Amazon testing this ultra-fast deliveries? 30 minutes or less. They're testing it out in Seattle and Philadelphia. And these are, you know, groceries, convenience store type of items that they are promoting as 30 minute or less. You can log on to the Amazon app, and then you can track your orders. You can tip the drivers, but they're testing this in Philly and Seattle.
So these are drivers, and not drones doing this.
I believe it's drivers at the moment.
Okay,
but I mean they started that drone program out in Pontiac, right?
Yeah.
So they're starting on the drone projects too. Pretty cool. All right, that's going to do it for us today. Kevin Dietz and Altaw coming your way next here on WJR. Have yourself a wonderful Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow.